The language of the Declaration of Independence is equally conclusive. It begins by declaring that when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect for the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. It then proceeds to say, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among them is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. The general words above quoted would seem to embrace the whole human family, and if they were used in a similar instrument at this day, would be so understood. But it is too clear for dispute that the enslaved African race were not intended to be included and formed no part of the people who framed and adopted this declaration. For if the language is understood in that day would embrace them, the conduct of the distinguished men who framed the Declaration of Independence would have been utterly and flagrantly inconsistent with the principles they asserted. And instead of the sympathy of mankind, to which they so confidently appealed, they would have deserved and received universal rebuke and reprobation. Yet the men who framed this declaration were great men, high in literary acquirements, high in their sense of honor, and incapable of asserting principles inconsistent with those on which they were acting. They perfectly understood the meaning of the language they used and how it would be understood by others, and they knew that it would not in any part of the civilized world be supposed to embrace the Negro race, which by common consent had been excluded from civilized governments and the family of nations and doomed to slavery. They spoke and acted according to the then established doctrines and principles and in the ordinary language of the day, and no one misunderstood them. The unhappy black race was separated from the white by indelible marks and laws long before established, and were never thought of or spoken of except as property, and when the claims of the owner or the profit of the trader were supposed to need protection. This state of public opinion had undergone no change when the Constitution was adopted, as is equally evident from its provisions and language. The brief preamble sets forth by whom it was formed, for what purposes, and for whose benefit and protection. It declares that it is formed by the people of the United States, that is to say, by those who were members of the different political communities of the several states, and its great object is declared to be to secure the blessings of liberty to themselves and their posterity. It speaks in general terms of the people of the United States and of citizens of the several states, when it is providing for the exercise of the powers granted or the privileges secured to these citizens. It does not define what description of persons are intended to be included under these terms or who shall be regarded as a citizen and one of the people. It uses them as terms so well understood that no further description or definition was necessary. But there are two clauses in the Constitution which point directly and specifically to the Negro race as a separate class of persons, and show clearly that they were not regarded as a portion of the people or citizens of the government then formed. One of these clauses reserves to each of the 13 states the right to import slaves until the year 1808, if it thinks proper. And the importation which it thus sanctions was unquestionably of persons of the race of which we are speaking, as the traffic in slaves in the United States had always been confined to them. And by the other provision, the states pledged themselves to each other to maintain the right of property of the master by delivering up to him any slave who may have escaped from his service and be found within their respective territories. By the first above-mentioned clause, therefore, the right to purchase and hold this property is directly sanctioned and authorized for 20 years by the people who framed the Constitution. And by the second, they pledged themselves to maintain and uphold the right of the master in the manner specified as long as the government they then formed should endure. And these two provisions show conclusively that neither the description of persons therein referred to, nor their descendants, were embraced in any of the other provisions of the Constitution, for certainly these two clauses were not intended to confer on them or their posterity the blessings of liberty or any of the personal rights so carefully provided for the citizen. No one of that race had ever migrated to the United States voluntarily. All of them had been brought here as articles of merchandise. The number that had been emancipated at that time were but few in comparison with those held in slavery, and they were identified in the public mind with the race to which they belonged and regarded as a part of the slave population rather than the free. It is obvious that they were not even in the minds of the framers of the Constitution when they were conferring special rights and privileges upon the citizens of a state in every other part of the Union. Indeed, when we look to the condition of this race in the several states at the time, it is impossible to believe that these rights and privileges were intended to be extended to them. It is very true that in that portion of the Union where the labor of the Negro race was found to be unsuited to the climate and unprofitable to the master, but few slaves were held at the time of the Declaration of Independence and when the Constitution was adopted. It had entirely worn out in one of them, and measures had been taken for its gradual abolition in several others. But this change had not been produced by any change of opinion in relation to this race, but because it was discovered from experience that slave labor was unsuited to the climate and productions of these states. For some of the states where it had ceased or nearly ceased to exist were actively engaged in the slave trade, procuring cargoes on the coast of Africa and transporting them for sale in those parts of the Union where their labor was found to be profitable and suited to the climate and productions. And this traffic was openly carried on, and fortunes accumulated by it without reproach from the people of the states where they resided. And it can hardly be supposed that in the states where it was then countenanced in its worst form, that is, in the seizure and transportation, the people could have regarded those who were emancipated as entitled to equal rights with themselves. And we may here again refer in support of this proposition to the plain and unequivocal language of the laws of the several states, some passed after the Declaration of Independence and before the Constitution was adopted, and some since that government went into operation. We need not refer on this point particularly to the laws of the present slaveholding states. Their statute books are full of provisions in relation to this class in the same spirit with the Maryland law which we have above quoted. They have continued to treat them as an inferior class and to subject them to strict police regulations, drawing a broad line of distinction between the citizen and the slave races, and legislating in relation to them upon the same principle which prevailed at the time of the Declaration of Independence. As relates to these states, it is too plain for argument that they have never been regarded as a part of the people or citizens of the state, nor supposed to possess any political rights which the dominant race might not withhold or grant at their pleasure. And as long ago as 1822, the Court of Appeals of Kentucky decided that free Negroes and mulattoes were not citizens within the meaning of the Constitution of the United States. And the correctness of this decision is recognized and the same doctrine affirmed. And if we turn to the legislation of the states where slavery had worn out or measures taken for its speedy abolition, we shall find the same opinions and principles equally fixed and equally acted upon. Thus, Massachusetts in 1786 passed a law similar to the colonial one of which we have spoken. The law of 1786, like the law of 1705, forbids the marriage of any white person with any Negro, Indian, or mulatto, and inflicts a penalty of £50 upon anyone who shall join them in marriage, and declares all such marriage absolutely null and void, and degrades thus the unhappy issue of the marriage by fixing upon it the stain of bastardy. And this mark of degradation was renewed and again impressed upon the race in the careful and deliberate preparation of their revised code published in 1836. This code forbids any person from joining in marriage any white person with any Indian, Negro, or mulatto, and subjects the party who shall offend in this respect to imprisonment not exceeding 6 months in the common jail, or to hard labor, and to a fine of not less than $50 nor more than $200. And like the law of 1786, it declares the marriage to be absolutely null and void. It will be seen that the punishment is increased by the code upon the person who shall marry them by adding imprisonment to a pecuniary penalty. So too in Connecticut. We refer more particularly to the legislation of this state because it was not only among the first to put an end to slavery within its own territory, but was the first to fix a mark of reprobation upon the African slave trade. The law last mentioned was passed in October 1788, about 9 months after the state had ratified and adopted the present Constitution of the United States. And by that law, it prohibited its own citizens under severe penalties from engaging in the trade and declared that all policies of insurance on the vessel or cargo made in the state to be null and void. But up to the time of the adoption of the Constitution, there is nothing in the legislation of the state indicating any change of opinion as to the relative rights and position of white and black races in this country, or indicating that it meant to place the latter, when free, upon a level with its citizens. And certainly nothing which would have led the slaveholding states to suppose that Connecticut designed to claim for them, under the new Constitution, equal rights and privileges and rank of citizens in every other state. The first step taken by Connecticut upon this subject was as early as 1774, when it passed an act forbidding the further importation of slaves into the state. But the section containing the prohibition was introduced by the following preamble: "And whereas the increase of slaves in this state is injurious to the poor and inconvenient." This recital would appear to have been carefully introduced in order to prevent any misunderstanding of the motive which induced the legislature to pass the law, and places it distinctly upon the interest and convenience of the white population, excluding the inference that it might have been intended in any degree for the benefit of the other. And in the Act of 1784, by which the issue of slaves born after the time therein mentioned were to be free at a certain age, the section is again introduced by a preamble assigning a similar motive for the act. It is in these words: "Whereas sound policy requires that the abolition of slavery should be effected as soon as may be consistent with the rights of individuals and the public safety and welfare," showing that the right of the property in the master was to be protected, and that the measure was one of policy, and to prevent the injury and inconvenience to the whites of the slave population in the state. And still further pursuing its legislation, we find that in the same statute passed in 1774, which prohibited the further importation of slaves into the state, there is also a provision by which any Negro, Indian, or mulatto servant who was found wandering out of the town or place to which he belonged without a written pass, such as is therein described, was made liable to be seized by anyone and taken before the next authority to be examined and delivered up to his master, who was required to pay the charge which had accrued thereby. And a subsequent section of the same law provides that if any free Negro shall travel without such pass and shall be stopped, seized, or taken up, he shall pay all charges arising thereby. And this law was in full operation when the Constitution of the United States was adopted and was not repealed till 1797. So that up to that time, free Negroes and mulattoes were associated with servants and slaves in the police regulations established by the laws of the state. And again, in 1833, Connecticut passed another law which made it penal to set up or establish any school in that state for the instruction of persons of the African race, not inhabitants of the state, or to instruct or teach in any such school or institution or board or harbor for that purpose any such person, without the previous consent in writing of the civil authority of the town in which such school or institution might be. And it appears by the case of Crandall versus the state that upon an information filed against Prudence Crandall for a violation of this law, one of the points raised in the defense was that the law was a violation of the Constitution of the United States, and that the persons instructed, although of the African race, were citizens of other states, and therefore entitled to the rights and privileges of the citizens of the state of Connecticut. But Chief Justice Daggett, before whom the case was tried, held that persons of that description were not citizens of a state within the meaning of the word citizen in the Constitution of the United States, and were therefore not entitled to the privileges and immunities of citizens in other states. The case was carried up to the Supreme Court of Errors of the state, and the question fully argued there, but the case went off upon another point and no opinion was expressed on this question. We have made this particular examination into the legislative and judicial action of Connecticut because from the early hostility it displayed to the slave trade on the coast of Africa, we may expect to find the laws of that state as lenient and favorable to the subject race as those of any other state in the Union. And if we find that at the time the Constitution was adopted, they were not even raised to the rank of citizens, but were still held and treated as property, and the laws relating to them passed with reference altogether to the interest and convenience of the white race, we shall hardly find them elevated to a higher rank anywhere else.